Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. In the study of Indigenous religions, one of the issues a scholar faces is the gap between self-representation and scholarly classification, particularly with regard to the concept of religion. No more so is this the case than in the study of Druidry in the UK, where scholars and practitioners are both conflicted with themselves and with each other about Druidry's status as a religion, or philosophy, or spirituality. To discuss the issue of Druidry in itself and this complicated issue of whether or not it's a religion, is Associate Senior Lecturer in Religious Studies at Leeds Trinity University College, Suzanne Owen. Suzanne's well known to us here at the University of Edinburgh. She received her PhD in Religious Studies from here, and for this she studied issues to do with non-native appropriations of Native American spirituality and conducted fieldwork among the Mi'kmaq communities in Newfoundland, researching the sharing of ceremonies. This led her to her current research investigating indigeneity and the category Indigenous religion. And in addition, she's currently researching contemporary forms of British and Irish Druidry, and has a chapter upcoming, authored with Team Utera, entitled The Category of Religion in Public Classification, Charity Registration, and the Druid Network in England and Wales. So, Suzanne, before we get into whether or not Druidry, which is a word I seem to struggle to say with my Northern Irish twang, whether or not it is a religion or not, can we just start with the basics? Like what is Druidry? I know that's quite a big question, but let's see what you come up with as your introductory statement, and we'll build from there.
It's quite interesting because when I'm reading forums, Druid forums, and as soon as somebody asks them, well, what's the Druid view of passivism, for instance, they'll start to say a little bit about, well, maybe what their views are, but then they'll try to extrapolate ideas from ancient Druidry. Well, what did ancient Druids believe or do? But of course, there's a problem that we actually don't know, because most of what's written about ancient Druidry is from other perspectives, like Roman perspectives, and when they were writing perhaps polemical pieces about the ancient Druids of the Britons and Gaul. So there is that initial, then, I guess, problem of defining Druidry, like, are we talking about the ancient Druids and contemporary Druids? And it's similar with paganism, this issue, because in the study of Christianity, they freely use the term pagan to refer to the, at that time of early Christianity, the Greeks and so forth. And it's a similar issue with Druidry. Then immediately you think, well, they're still around. That's what people say, Druids are still around. And it's really not the case that they're still around. It's that they're using the same term. But I would say that it's actually a very different expression that is expressed, that's being articulated and practiced in contemporary Druidry from ancient Druidry. And I wouldn't even want to say that one has become the other in any kind of form. But you will see practitioners maybe try to legitimate or trace back through the past and whatever sources or records that they can come up with. But in the same time, it really isn't about that. And I think many contemporary Druids would agree that it's really a response to the land that they live in, is how they might just articulate it. And so for Druidry is a British response to the land of the Britons in Ireland. And this is in some ways that their sources are the land itself and what is within it. But of course, that has its own issues as well, particularly if you're looking at Druidry in other countries that are not in Britain or Western Europe. Yeah. And that's where it becomes interesting as well.
Okay. So we'll get on to the other context in a minute, but I'm just going to rhetorically throw at you the question of, isn't Druidry just a Victorian reinvention, really? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, is there a clear line of history? Certainly, when people think of Druidry, we think, oh, it's going back, what, 3,000 years or whatever, but I think I'm right in saying that it's something that's emerged quite comparatively recently as in its contemporary form. Mm-hmm. So if you could...
Well, even just before the Victorians, the whole interest in, I guess, British history and Welsh and Irish history probably as well, started to emerge, and people were really trying to find out, I guess, these kinds of connections or to rediscover these aspects in this time. And that's an interesting question, like, what is that in response to? Is it a response to a kind of globalization that was going on in the 1600s that leading into the 1700s? Because a lot of these Druid societies, they were basically founded by Freemasons or people who were like that. And they were setting up friendly societies that were basically secular, I suppose you want to use that term, and their purpose and organization, but they had a real strong interest in English heritage, obviously because it's, these Victorians were mainly operating out of London and places like that, even though Edward Williams, who is responsible for a lot of the sources now in contemporary Druidry, he was very much interested and helped to promote Welsh, I guess, nationalist interests, which eventually became, well, which is still one of the sources for the Welsh Gorsedd, which people like Queen Elizabeth and the Archbishop of Canterbury are members of. So there is that line of Druidry from, I guess, the early Victorians and just before, which led to this kind of interest in culture and heritage. But the pagan forms of Druidry, I guess if you want to call that, is another development, I guess, that came out of perhaps an interest in environmentalism. I guess a kind of romantic element, perhaps, as well, in terms of whereas what has industrialization, you know, led to, and how can we get back into a relationship with nature or whatever like that. And that's another development that is in some ways linked but also separate to the friendly society's version of Druidry. Yet there's also another thread which is through Christian tradition, because particularly like here in Scotland, where you have things like the Ceilidhe, the Culdies as they're sometimes called, which also have a kind of a vaguely Druid element or link, or so they like to think so. And there are contemporary forms of that who are who would identify as being Christian, the practitioners of this or a related tradition, while still being Christian as well. And so there's many people who are following that line. So those are kind of three threads that I'm interested in, but there are probably others as well.
Yeah.
Secular Druids and so forth.
I believe David wants to.
Can I jump in there? In the US, Wicca was picked up by very progressive left-wing groups, particularly thinking of the sort of feminist forms of prayer of people like Starhawk and so on. Whereas in Britain, especially in the early days of Wicca, the early practitioners were largely conservative. I wondered if that was a pattern that carried through Druidry as well, despite the interest in the ecology and green issues, which we would now think of being left wing, they're sort of harking back to this golden age as an intrinsically conservative idea.
Absolutely. I think also that the founders of contemporary Druidry and like people like Gardner for Wicca were friends, and they were basically supporting each other and sharing ideas, and so there are many commonalities between the two because of that. But they obviously, there's certain differences in terms of the kind of, I guess, who's attracted to these traditions as well, I think is quite different.
Could you expand on that?
I think Wicca has really been adopted in the US by those who are looking for feminist theologies like Starhawk. And that has become quite a popular version. I wouldn't say it's so necessarily strong in Britain. There's a cliche that Druidry is more solar and Wicca is more lunar, but I think that's an essentialism. But in terms of leadership, it's obviously they were founded by men, both of them. And but they're both inclusive, of course, of female leadership, and there's an equal opportunity for leadership among other genders. and other genders, both for any gender. And so there is an openness and inclusiveness in that which isn't apparent, perhaps, in Victorian times. In other, the only problem with Victorian Druidry is that it was men only. So we're talking about a different generation there between those that founded Wicca and contemporary Druidry or pagan Druidry. So those that still have exist that were founded in the 1700s are still male only. And they, you know, they still thrive in some pockets here and there. But so that's why we have to really speak about which Druidry we're talking about, or Druidism, as I say, is another term that's been used for the idea.
I know that when I googled Druidry the other day in the UK, certainly there are a number of organisations, and we'll be talking specifically maybe about the Druid Network situation, but there's also, of course, the British Druid Order, and I'm sure there are other organisations out there which claim to represent Druidry.
Well, let's say the Order of Bards, Obits and Druids is quite important because they were quite early in developing a correspondence course so that people in Australia, US, France, anywhere in the world could then do a correspondence course in Druidry, and that has been quite influential.
To become qualified as a Druid?
Yes, through three stages or three grades. They're not meant to be hierarchical because there are different specialisms. Yeah. But the Druid is meant to have specialized or at least experienced the different grades. Whereas there's no levels intended, like if somebody wants to specialize in the lowest grade or the first grade, should I say, the bardic grade, and they are musicians and artists, they will specialize in that.
And
I think many musicians and artists have been attracted to Druidry over time because it is something that really blends well with what they are doing. The Ovid grade, as it's called. I mean, this is stuff that comes from Edward Williams' work again, who was the founder of the Welsh Gorseth and so forth, trying to determine what is Druidry from ancient sources and kind of producing a... he tried to say that these texts were ancient, but they were found to be written by him, of course. And
another Wicca.
So the Ovate is the second grade. The fact that you do one and then the other and then the other makes it appear like it's levels that you're going through, like BA to MA to PhD, but it isn't meant to be. Nobody certainly conceives it that way.
Okay.
The Ovate is concentrated on things like healing and divination. And the Druid grade is meant to be the third grade, which has knowledge of the others and more. And but this is where there is a debate about whether or not you can call yourself a druid if you're not in that third stage. But of course, a lot of druid groups don't even have the grades, like the Druid Network.
Okay. Before we get too more in depth, we haven't really just touched upon... I don't want to reduce it to beliefs, as we were talking about earlier.
Beliefs and practices.
But amongst this whole disparate network of different groups and individuals practicing, quote, Druidry, unquote, what are the kind of unifying characteristics? Mm. If you were to say Druidry in a nutshell, just so that people really know what we're talking about.
Yeah, because that's... the one that I want to propose, but does not apply to the Friendly Society's form of Druidry. So if we talk about mainly those who have grown out the pagan style or alternative, I'm not quite sure what to call it, but anyway, those that were from Order of Bards, Obits and Druids and other related groups, I would say the concept of Awen is quite common, and this was another contribution from Edward Williams as well. And the concept itself has been loosely translated from Welsh to mean inspiration.
Okay.
And so that means that you would think that Druidry is primarily experiential in nature, which makes it quite open and resistant to doctrinal statements in that sense.
Mm.
And they see that if you kind of receiving this inspiration, or however you want to conceive it, that can lead to the practice of musical expressions or divinatory expressions or wisdom. You know, so it leads into all, or feeds into, or it was what sort of gives us this thing called Druidry.
Mm.
But it means that it's quite individual in that sense. So that's on one hand, you have the concept of Arwen being central or acknowledged as, well, I've come across it in almost every Druid group, but I've not attended, the groups I've attended have tended to fall around the kind of more pagan forms of Druidry, although I did go to one Christian Druid group, but Arwen was still present.
Yeah.
So I was put forward that idea.
Yeah.
Another one is the ritualistic aspect, which there is a kind of commonality in terms of this type of Druidry, again, not the Victorian or the friendly societies types, to have a kind of relationship with the outdoors in some way, with nature, with trees or stones or the earth in some way. And not that any particular place is more sacred, for instance, or than another. Any place would do. You know, the early Druids in Victorian times met on Primrose Hill in London. And some people may say there could be some kind of ancient connections to that place. Of course, there probably are. But it probably is also an open green space. You know, it could be practical reasons as well. And so they tend to look at that more than other aspects in terms of where, when they're performing at the ritual side. And so you can say it tends to, most Druids seem to accept this eightfold division of the year, which roughly relate to seasonal changes. And so depending on where you are in the world, the seasons will be very different, and you're meant to adapt this to your latitude or your wherever you are, and relate to them in terms of your local environment. And so in Northern Europe, we have things like, we're coming up to the festival of Beltane, you know, which is traditionally 1st of May, but some people might calculate it according to the lunar phases or other phases, so it doesn't necessarily have to be the 1st of May exactly. And so Druid groups will be meeting between now and sometime after the 1st of May. There'll be various things going on, and they're all different, what they do. There might be an acknowledgement of the different directions, the four directions that you find in a lot of pagan ritual, the kind of circular aspect that you find in many pagan rituals. Acknowledgement, not necessarily in Druidry, there's an ambiguity, I think there's an ambiguity towards deity in Druidry. There are some who would acknowledge God as a singular, some goddess as singular, or god and goddess, like the more Wiccan conceptions. And they might call themselves Druid witches, even, that they kind of blend both. And then you get those who are basically either animist or atheistic, who don't really like talking about gods at all. And there are lots of them. And so you get that tolerance for it, but also kind of vagueness, because in many of the Druid rituals I've attended, they will refer to spirits of place, or acknowledge like the spirit and not give it a name or a gender or anything. So it's meant to be trying to be inclusive, and then people interpret it how they like. Trying to find the kind of neutral ground there for all participants.
I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in again. Can you then, given if there's a commonality that can be discerned amongst the neo-pagan milieu, perceived broadly and rather dismissively, it would be veneration of nature and the use of the wheel of the year. I mean, I think these are the only things that you could count as commonality amongst all of them. Where then does heathenism... No.
Yes.
Druidry fit in amongst... Wicca, yes. Heathenism. I was thinking about the Northern European versions of it. Where does it fit in? How do they
Also, how do they relate to the other ones? I mean, what's their position in that milieu? Given that it's a milieu which maybe people aren't aware, is really quite organised. They have an identity, this sort of neat pagan umbrella, and they really operate as an organisation called paganism at one level, but then these sub-identities. Mm.
For many, it may come down to preferences of the pantheon that they like to work with. Although you get druids that might use different pantheons and might even be dependent on where they are. And so heathenry, of course, favors the Germanic or Norse pantheon and might be interested in runes and so forth. And so then they may start to identify themselves as heathens. But there are also practices within heathenry which are very different from other ones. As I said, I don't study that, but I do know they have something called Seder, for instance, which is broadly, I guess, a kind of prophetic practice or shamanistic practice, if you want to use that term. And that is considered a heathen practice, although you may get druids who are interested in it and want to learn it and do it too. So there's a lot of crossover and sharing of ideas, as has always gone on. And that's just one of the big questions: what makes Druidry different? And one of the sort of sociological observations, you could say, is that Druidry has tended to attract a number of academics and other people who are perhaps in official positions, teachers, lawyers. And then there seems to be more of an acceptance or respectability in that sense, or links to establishment within Druidry. And some of this is...
The Queen, for instance.
Well, if the Queen is a member of the Welsh Gorseth, and there's other Gorseths which are definitely part of cultural or regional interests, like the Cornish one, which is all... It becomes a kind of a local regional event or festival, and you get like the mayor involved and other people involved. So there is that kind of aspect which I think has developed from what people perceive to have been the role of the Druid in ancient Britain, where they see the ancient Druid as being someone who has been involved in politics, maybe as someone who helps to, negotiate between the different parties, or advise the king or the chief, or even the popular character of Merlin in the court of King Arthur. And I think there has been then a kind of maybe a semi-conscious acceptance of the fact that the Druid is someone who is involved in social life, in the public life, that you don't get with some of the other traditions. And maybe this is perhaps something that's fed into why the Druid Network or any kind of form of Druidry might be acceptable for the Charity Commission too.
I mean, the thing about this whole thing, like, is moving on to the idea of, is Druidry a religion? We know that the outgoing Archbishop of Canterbury is a member of the Gorsa.
Yes.
And so he's a Druid, but a member, he's the head of the Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a religion? How can people be members of one religious group and Druidry as well?
It's an interesting process, I think, because I would say culturally, with particular groups like pagan groups, they are, some ways, many members that I've met are actually falling away from or trying to get away from church organizations. And they're very critical of their own upbringing. Like, many of them have been brought up into various church traditions, and they are kind of trying to get away from that. If they're trying to get away from the kind of patriarchal model of the church upbringing, then they're quite attracted to the more diverse or female positive imagery, in that sense.
Inclusive,
yes. And so you do have then, they are kind of replacing it. So they may have been in the religion of Catholicism, and now they are doing this. And so they become to think, well, we have to kind of build this up to be part of or all-encompassing in one's life. So they start to then add it into their life and their worldview and into the practice. And so for them, they may see it as kind of the alternative to religion, but not necessarily religion itself.
Mm.
In terms of whether Druidry is a religion, it is something that is probably generally rejected by many Druids because of the association with what religion is. They associate it with institutions, dogma, things which, in terms of the organization, being top down, perhaps. And this is what they're resisting against, and so they would reject the idea that what they're doing is like that. In fact, what they're doing is meant to be resisting that, resisting certain types of hierarchy. And
what about the term spirituality?
Well, many would accept that, and this is to link it with my other work with the Native Americans. Vindaloria Jr., a renowned, respected historian of Native American religions, who's also from Dakota background, and he uses the term spirituality. And so I asked him, well, why spirituality? And he said, because it is more, how did he put it? But anyway, to get away from the idea of institution, dogma, and everything else. So he thought spirituality was a term that moved away from that idea of institution and dogma. And so he was happy with the term spirituality.
That's my suspicion, is that's how that term's used.
But it's not what it originally meant, of course, but should we correct them? No, because obviously what it meant in medieval times is completely different from how it's being used now. And different groups use it in different ways, because I think how the Native Americans are using the term is much more communal in its outlook than maybe people here at the Theosophical Society, which might see it as something more individualistic.
Yeah.
And the Native American would say, no, it's about tradition and the community.
Should scholars care whether a group defines itself as religious or not?
Some scholars care. I'm ambiguous about it. I don't. I'm interested in why they want to call themselves religious or spiritual. It doesn't matter to me. Or I don't want to say whether this is religion or not.
Mm.
I know many scholars do, and they put forward definitions of religion, but then that just shows what their assumptions about religion are.
Mm.
And so whether or not what I'm doing is sitting on the fence or not, I would say in some ways it isn't, because I'm actually saying that it really doesn't matter whether it's a religion or not. It's what's interesting is why.
Hmm. Finally, I have been promising throughout that we're going to talk about it, and for continuity between my introduction and the actual interview, I feel that we should talk about the Druid Network and charitable status.
Hmm.
But I think I will leave it up to you to break it down to its most essential. But there, essentially, it was in 2010, mm-hmm. wasn't it, that the Druid Network, who are one of a number of Druid organisations in the UK, were granted the legal and charitable status of a religion. So I guess, why did they want to do that? What do they gain from that? And what do their members and other Druids think about it? And what is it?
Yes, this is the topic of the paper that Timu and I wrote. But I'll say just briefly that they had to register as something, but did they want to register as a limited company? And that was kind of, we're Druids, they don't want a limited company. Although other Druid organizations are. I mean, there are some that are.
Why didn't they have to register as something?
Because they had an income, even though it was modest, just through membership fees, and they maintained the website, the Druid Network, which is like they promote themselves as a facilitator of many, whatever Druids want to do, they will help facilitate it within their, within the definition of what they can do. obviously it's going to be non-profit if they're going to be registering as a charity. So they wanted to go that way because they didn't want to make a profit. They didn't want to become a company. And so but there are other categories they could have registered under within charity law. Why the advancement of religion? That is due to the founder, Emma Restall-Orr herself, wanted to register as a religious charity. And there are many reasons why. She wrote a paper about this, which is available through the Druid Network, that she saw that religion is taken more seriously. Because looking at all these groups, these fringe groups, if you want to call them that, as that's how they're perceived, or even things like Jedi or other types of groups, that people think that they're all made up, and that's how Druidry is treated as well, that they're all made up. And whether or not they are all made up, which you could say is true of any religious tradition or other tradition, there is this kind of quality of religion that makes it seem more serious and less trivial, and it comes down to that. And this is even in European law as well, about they will not accept a religion if it's a trivial religion. They will reject it in cases that might come up. And so, and then by being treated as a serious religion, then it is easier to gain access to, if there's a druid who wants to access patients in hospitals or prisoners who might be pagan, or to use facilities. As I say, it's not about money. That's the first thing I must say. It's not about tax benefits, because they don't really have that much of an income to make a difference. It's all about in terms of how they're being treated or regarded, and it's about respect. And currently, in our climate, religion seems to maybe have that, or can give that, having that label. In the past, maybe not. Maybe that would make things worse for them. But at the moment, religion seems to be a good thing, according to various recent governments. And so that's why I think it's useful now to maybe register as a religion, to gain that respectability. And of course, the reaction to those who are against the Druids is that, oh no, they're going to now have a category on the census and be taught in schools, which of course they are being taught in schools, but all sorts of things are being taught in schools, even humanism, so it's not a problem with that, but it will never have its own category in the census. That's, just the same way that Quaker doesn't have their own category in the census, so it's not going to be that.
What's that in numbers?
The census is a whole other area.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll
lumping all Christians as Christian is a big problem.
Yeah.
But there was a movement for the last census, the census from pagans, that everybody ought to write down that they are pagan-druid, pagan-wicca, pagan-heathen, so that when they add up the numbers, so somebody speculated there'll be as many pagans as there are Buddhists. Because Buddhists are divided between different Buddhist groups, so you could argue that it's true with pagans as well. We're divided between different, or they're divided between different groups. So there's a kind of political, there is a savviness amongst many of these groups. So the Druids are savvy. They're trying to see, what benefit will we have by doing this? But there are many who think that this is the wrong way to go, and they don't want to promote Druidry in that sense. They don't want to have, they don't want to become part of the establishment in that sense. And so they are furious, many of them are furious. And some members have left the Druid Network because of this as well. Because they see that it's going down, if you're going to become part of the establishment, it means you're going to be limiting who you are or what it is. And it does. I mean, the way that when during the application for with the Charity Commission, they had to translate what they do and what they believe into the language of the Charity Commission in order to be understood.
Yeah.
And that means that will then become a basis of defining Druidry in the future. because it's going to be really difficult now for any other Druid group to register as a charity without referring to the Druid Network case and their articulation of Druidry. And so in that sense, it becomes a paradigm. And their model of Druidry becomes the official model. I wouldn't say that Druidry is now an official religion. That's not what's happened here. The Druid Network is now registered as a charity that furthers religion.
Okay.
But in order to do that, they had to recognize Druidry as a religion. So in some ways, you can say that, yes, the charity law has recognized Druidry as a religion through this process. But it doesn't mean it's made Druidry an official religion.
Yeah.
There is no official religion, maybe except the Church of England or England. But you can call yourself Jedi and practice as Jedi if you want in England. It's no different. So it's a real subtle difference there about what is...
A similar thing happened in Norway where they do have an officially recognised religion. There's a state church, and that's the only officially recognised state religion. And the pagans, I'm not sure if it was Wiccans or... The local pagan federation more generally campaigned to be recognised as an official religion.
Mm.
And they were in court for years and years, and it didn't happen. Because people involved in the decision making were part of the official Protestant church. It was the state church, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, there isn't even a register in England and Wales for religions. There is no register. Which it makes it quite different from other countries, like the Scandinavian countries, where there is an official registration. All of those kinds of things. It's a unique case, I think, in terms of how things operate in Britain, which is a bit weird with the Church of England.
Thank you, Suzanne. Wonderful
You're
to speak
welcome.
To you. Well, as you could probably tell, Chris and I had a lot of fun speaking to Suzanne that day. In fact, there was a considerable chunk of that interview which we had to cut out for running time reasons, so hopefully we'll be able to broadcast that to you in another form somewhere down the line. Obviously we'll be publishing our response to Suzanne later this week, this time by Essie Michaela, and we'll also be having a report from the AASR conference at some point this week also. And obviously on Friday, as always, we'll be publishing our Opportunities Digest, now available in PDF as well for you to print out or send around your department. That's the end of our series on new religious movements with Gordon Melton, Wouter Hanegraaff. Obviously a great deal of discussion about Wouter Hanegraaff's podcast and Damon Lycurinos's response from last week. So make sure you check out the Facebook page and the comments on the website to keep up with all that. But next week, move on to a short series based around the idea of the sacred. Next week, Gordon Lynch is talking to Jonathan about the sacred. And the following week, Jonathan again speaking to Robert Orsi about Rudolf Otto, an important early scholar of religion. And following that, we have an interview with Chris talking to Brian Victoria about Zen Buddhism and terrorism. We have a few other things coming up in the pipeline, including our first book review show, which we hope to have out in 3 or 4 weeks' time. We'll be recording that on Halloween. But as always, I'll remind you that you can follow the Religious Studies Project on Facebook, on our Twitter account, Project RS, and also on iTunes. And if you download the podcast via iTunes, we'd appreciate it if you would give us a rating. That helps us to get the podcast to people who wouldn't normally come into contact with it. And, as always, thanks for listening.